All the Dangerous Things has captivated readers with its haunting exploration of maternal guilt, sleep deprivation, and the devastating consequences of buried family secrets. Stacey Willingham's sophomore thriller, following her best-selling debut, A Flicker in the Dark, has been praised by Reese Witherspoon, who selected it for her book club, calling it a masterful thriller that kept me guessing until the final page. The novel's chilling portrayal of a mother's worst nightmare resonates deeply with readers, particularly in how it examines the societal pressures placed on women and mothers. With its atmospheric Southern Gothic setting and unreliable narrator, the book has drawn comparisons to Gillian Flynn's Sharp Objects while establishing Willingham as a distinctive new voice in psychological suspense. Isabel Drake hasn't slept in 364 days. Not since her 2-year-old son Mason was taken from his crib in the middle of the night. For nearly 9,000 hours, she's existed in a hazy, semi-conscious state, sustained by a dangerous cocktail of caffeine, eye drops, and sleeping pills that never work. Her daily routine has become mechanical: 20 cups of coffee, constant eye drops to keep her burning eyes open, and sleeping pills that only leave her in a foggy twilight state. As a keynote speaker at True Crime Con, she introduces herself with the stark truth that has become her identity. "My name is Isabel Drake, and my son, Mason, was kidnapped 1 year ago. His case is still unsolved." The audience of 3,000 hangs on her every word, consuming her tragedy like entertainment, a fact that both disgusts and motivates her. Many wear true crime merchandise, shirts emblazoned with serial killer quotes, hoodies featuring prison mugshots, and accessories decorated with fake blood spatter, making bile rise in her throat. She scans the crowd with practiced precision: middle-aged women seeking escape from suburban monotony, embarrassed husbands and boyfriends dragged along unwillingly, solitary figures with unnervingly long stares, and stone-faced police officers watching from the back, perhaps hoping for a break in their cold cases. This is her life now, reliving her trauma publicly while privately obsessing over every microscopic detail of Mason's disappearance. She remembers everything about that night: the pale blue dinosaur pajamas he wore, the slight squeak of his bedroom door, the empty silence that greeted her morning check. The baby monitor showed no interference, the security system remained armed, and Mason's favorite stuffed giraffe still lay on his pillow, as if he had simply vanished into thin air. On the flight home to Georgia, Isabel meets Waylon Spencer, a true crime podcaster known for his investigative work on cold cases. His podcast, Unsolved and Unforgotten, has helped solve 3 missing persons cases in the past year. Despite her initial reluctance, she's grown weary of attention-seeking media vultures. She eventually agrees to work with him, desperate to keep Mason's case in the public eye. Back in her Savannah home, she maintains what she calls her wall of suspects, hundreds of photos covering every inch of her home office. Church directories, faculty yearbooks, local mugshots, newspaper clippings, and social media screenshots create an obsessive collage of potential suspects. She's memorized every face, researched every background, and created detailed timelines for each person who might have crossed paths with Mason. Someone out there knows what happened to her son, and she won't rest, literally and figuratively, until she finds them. Long before Mason's disappearance, Isabel's life was shaped by another tragedy. Growing up in the historic Hayworth Mansion in Beaufort, South Carolina, young Isabel struggled with sleepwalking episodes that terrified her 6-year-old sister, Margaret. "You were doing it again," Margaret would say, finding Isabel wandering the house at night, her body acting independently from her mind. One particularly hot July, their air conditioner broke down, forcing the sisters to sleep with windows open to catch the marsh breeze. While exploring her mother's art studio, Isabel discovered a disturbing painting partially hidden behind others. It showed their backyard at night with a girl standing ankle-deep in the marsh, wearing a white nightgown with long brown hair. When Margaret appeared beside her and pointed at the figure, saying, "Look, Izzy, it's you," Isabel felt a chill that had nothing to do with the heat. The next morning, Isabel woke to an unsettling silence: no cicadas, no birds, as if the world had stopped turning. The marsh smell was overpowering, her carpet was wet, and Margaret was missing. In the bathroom, she found puddles and damp towels in the corner. Looking in the mirror, she realized she was wearing a different nightgown than the night before, with smears of pluff mud behind her ear. Downstairs, her parents sat silently at the kitchen table. When she asked about Margaret, her father said simply, "She had an accident." As police cars arrived, he coached her on what to say, that she slept through the night, didn't hear anything, and only learned about Margaret's accident when she went downstairs that morning. Though hiding evidence, the wet carpet, mud behind her ear, changed nightgown, Isabel convinced herself this was a good lie. But deep down, she knew her father wasn't protecting Margaret. He was protecting her. Isabel's relationship with her husband, Ben, began with deception. They first met at an oyster roast by the Savannah River, where she spilled beer on him and they shared an easy conversation about writing. Caught up in the moment, she impulsively kissed him, only to discover later that he was married, and worse, her new boss at the Grid newspaper. Their paths crossed again professionally, with Ben praising an article she'd submitted about a grieving dolphin mother pushing her dead calf through Beaufort Harbor. An old dockhand had explained, "Dolphins have emotions like us. Nothing about grief makes sense, not for any of us." These words would later take on painful significance in Isabel's life. 3 days after Ben stopped coming to the office, Isabel learned the shocking news. His wife, Allison, had died, either by suicide or accidental overdose. At the memorial service, Ben found Isabel on the back porch and confessed that, despite all the people he'd spoken to, she was who he most wanted to see. He revealed his marriage had been troubled. Allison had a problem he couldn't handle. As Isabel comforted him, insisting it wasn't his fault, they ended up kissing passionately while Allison's grieving mother collapsed inside. Their relationship progressed quickly after that. Isabel left her job at the Grit to go freelance, allowing them to eventually go public. Their wedding was small and intimate in Chippewa Square. Initially, neither wanted children. Ben was too career-focused, and Isabel feared failing at motherhood after what happened with Margaret. But as years passed and their marriage grew stale, Isabel secretly flushed her birth control pills, hoping a baby would bring Ben home more and give her a chance to redeem her past failures. When she discovered she was pregnant, beneath the joy and excitement, her very first reaction was an unexpected stab of regret. The night Mason disappeared started like any other evening in their suburban home. Isabel put him to bed at 7, following their usual routine: bath time, pajamas with the dinosaur print he loved, and his favorite bedtime story about a brave little knight. She made sure his beloved nightlight cast its familiar blue glow across the room, adjusted his covers one last time, and quietly closed his door. Downstairs, she and Ben settled into their typical evening ritual, sharing a bottle of Merlot while watching a forgettable crime drama, the irony of which would later haunt her. At 11, during her final check before bed, Mason was sleeping peacefully, his small chest rising and falling in the dim light. The next morning stretched endlessly as Isabel busied herself with breakfast preparation and household chores, assuming Mason was sleeping late, as he sometimes did. It wasn't until 8 a.m. that mounting anxiety drove her to check his room, 8 crucial hours lost while their 3-year-old son was missing. The investigation revealed 3 unsettling clues that would torment Isabel for months. First, the window, which she distinctly remembered closing and latching the previous evening, stood open, curtains stirring in the morning breeze. Second, a single adult-sized shoe print marked the muddy earth beneath the window, its partial impression suggesting someone had landed there. Most devastating was finding Rex, Mason's cherished stuffed dinosaur, sodden and mud-stained on the marsh banks half a mile away, the last trace of their son. Law enforcement deployed every resource. Helicopters swept the area in expanding circles, dive teams combed a marsh's murky depths, and canine units tracked scents that led nowhere. As days turned to weeks, the investigation hit dead end after dead end. No suspects emerged, no meaningful leads materialized. Isabel transformed their dining room into an investigation center, walls covered with maps, timelines, and photographs. But something darker gnawed at her consciousness, a persistent feeling that crucial memories lay just beyond her reach. Her history of deep sleeping had once been a running joke. She'd slept through everything from thunderstorms to fire alarms. More troubling was her childhood sleepwalking, a condition her parents had documented extensively. Though she believed she'd outgrown it, stress had triggered episodes in her college years. These anxieties drove her to review the baby monitor recordings, leading to a horrifying discovery. There she was, moving like a phantom through Mason's room at 2 a.m., standing unnaturally still beside his crib for 2 hours, face blank and unreadable in the infrared light. The following night's footage proved even more disturbing. She watched herself lift Mason from his crib, cradling him against her chest with mechanical precision. When she saw herself turn toward the door, Isabel slammed the laptop shut, terror freezing her fingers on the keyboard. What had her sleeping self done with their son? When Waylon moves into Isabel's guest room to help with the investigation, their relationship initially seems promising. But late one night, Isabel discovers Waylon has been lying. He already had a well-worn copy of Mason's case file, despite pretending to see it for the first time, and his laptop contains a folder labeled X with dozens of photos of her from different periods of her life, including surveillance-like candids of her and Ben. Most disturbing, she finds he's been researching Margaret's drowning from 1999. Confronting him the next morning, Waylon finally reveals his true beliefs. There was no intruder. Despite his claims about helping her find Mason, he believes she killed her son. Furious at this betrayal, Isabel demands he leave immediately. What hurts most isn't just the betrayal, but the realization that now, with startling certainty, she believes it too. Desperate for answers, Isabel visits Ben at his expensive downtown condo. When she directly asks if he left because she did something to Mason that she doesn't remember, he simply tells her she won't find what she's looking for here. The revelation that Ben has moved on with Valerie, a therapist from a church support group who resembles Isabel, hits her hard. While she's remained trapped in grief, Ben has found comfort with someone who can actually help him heal. Realizing she needs to return to the beginning, not the night Mason disappeared, but the night Margaret died, Isabel drives to her childhood home in Beaufort. There, she confronts her parents about her fragmented memories, insisting that she remembers being there when Margaret died. Her father tries to shut down the conversation with the same coaching words he'd used years ago. "Your sister had an accident, sweetie. It was nobody's fault." In her parents' home, Isabel discovers her mother's completed painting of that fateful night. It shows three figures walking into the water together under a full moon, one with brown hair, one small with caramel-colored locks, and between them, not a girl in a nightgown as she'd thought, but someone wearing a robe. As this realization hits her, her mother appears, tears streaming down her face. "Isabel, honey, let me explain." The devastating truth emerges. Isabel wasn't responsible for Margaret's death as she'd believed all these years. Her mother, suffering from untreated postpartum psychosis after losing another daughter, Eloise, led both girls to the marsh that night. "I was sick, Isabel. I was very, very sick," she explains. Her mother had attempted to harm them before, leaving gas on overnight, hoping they would all wake up somewhere else together. That night, she beckoned Margaret into the water and tried to take Isabel too, leaving those mud marks on her neck. Her father arrived in time to save Isabel but not Margaret, then orchestrated a cover-up with the local police chief to protect the family name. At the cemetery, Isabel finds Margaret's grave beside another small headstone, Eloise Annabelle Rhett, who lived just one day. This explains everything. Her sleepwalking began after Ellie's death, a trauma they were never allowed to discuss. Reading her mother's medical records reveals her diagnosis: postpartum psychosis, a very rare, severe, yet treatable condition made worse by trauma, grief, and isolation. The symptoms, delusions, inability to sleep, paranoia, were all there, if only someone had cared enough to notice and help her. Just as Isabel begins to believe she might not have harmed Mason after all, another revelation shatters her tentative peace. Waylon Spencer, the persistent investigator who's been hovering at the edges of her life, is Allison's brother. This connection explains his dogged pursuit of the case, but not in the way Isabel expected. He's been hiding his connection to Ben all along, investigating not because he suspects Isabel, but because, as he states with quiet certainty, "I know Ben killed her." The revelation comes during a tense conversation in Waylon's cramped office, surrounded by case files and old photographs of his sister. Waylon methodically lays out his evidence. Though Allison's death was officially ruled an overdose, he discovered irregularities in the toxicology report and suspicious banking transactions in the weeks before her death. Most crucially, he reveals that Allison was 8 weeks pregnant when she died, a fact Ben knew but deliberately concealed from Isabel throughout their marriage. The pregnancy would have forced Ben to make choices he'd been avoiding, potentially derailing his carefully constructed life plans. This information forces Isabel to completely reframe her understanding of Ben. She realizes his seemingly passive approach to life's major decisions was actually calculated manipulation. Every go-with-the-flow moment was carefully orchestrated to maintain control while appearing uninvolved. The possibility emerges that Ben might have orchestrated not only Allison's death, but also Mason's disappearance, perhaps to avoid another situation where a child could trap him. The final piece falls into place when Isabel makes an impromptu visit to Valerie's home, intending to warn her about Ben's true nature. While Valerie makes tea in the kitchen, Isabel notices a photo album carelessly left open on the side table. The images inside freeze her blood. Ben and Valerie together at a lake house, dated 2 years ago when Mason was just 6 months old. More photos follow, secret meetings, stolen moments, all while Isabel was away on business trips she now realizes Ben had encouraged her to take. The truth crashes down with devastating clarity. Ben had been bringing Valerie to their home while Isabel was working, and Mason, now nearly three, would soon be old enough to innocently mention the other woman to his mother. Valerie must have taken him to protect their secret, perhaps believing she could finally have the family she wanted with Ben. When confronted with this revelation, Valerie's demeanor shifts from practiced warmth to glacial detachment. Looking directly at Isabel, she delivers a cruel assessment. Some people just aren't fit to be mothers. She refuses to reveal Mason's whereabouts, her silence speaking volumes about what she might have done. The tension explodes as Isabel, driven by maternal rage and desperation, lunges at Valerie. Their bodies collide with violent force, sending them crashing through the glass coffee table with a sickening crack of skull against floor, a sound that will haunt Isabel's nightmares for years to come. 2 days after Valerie's death, Detective Dozier arrives with a new lead. A client from Valerie's grief counseling group mentioned a woman named Abigail Fisher, who stopped attending after Mason's disappearance. Isabel recognizes the name from her True Crime Con attendee list, the woman whose intense gaze had disturbed her during her presentation. They finally have a suspect who might have taken Mason. The investigation traces the deleted online comment, "He's in a better place," to Abigail Fisher, who had Mason all along. Valerie had convinced the grieving, childless woman that Mason had an unfit mother and would be better with someone else. After a year apart, Mason is returned to Isabel, who can finally enter his nursery again, seeing him with his cleaned, stuffed dinosaur, the evidence that led to his recovery. Ben, meanwhile, is imprisoned for Valerie's murder, with damning evidence, his ring beneath her couch, and DNA under Valerie's fingernails. What Ben doesn't know is that Isabel killed Valerie and planted his ring as evidence, knowing how easily police would believe the married man and his mistress narrative. In the end, Isabel reflects on how our lives become stories we tell ourselves and others until we believe them. Her podcast with Waylon has covered everything: Ben's suspected involvement in Allison's death, his manipulation of Isabel, and his alleged murder of Valerie. Her parents have reached out to mend their relationship after years of silence about Margaret and Ellie. Most importantly, Isabel has finally found peace with herself, understanding that she wasn't responsible for either Margaret's or Mason's fate. The dangerous things that haunted her life were not her own actions, but the secrets others kept from her. Secrets that, once revealed, finally allowed her to sleep again. At its core, All the Dangerous Things explores the impossible standards society places on mothers. Isabel, her mother Elizabeth, and even Valerie and Abigail Fisher all exist in what Willingham calls that murky middle of right and wrong, making difficult choices under tremendous pressure. Isabel's mother suffered from untreated postpartum psychosis at a time when women's mental health concerns were routinely dismissed. Isabel herself felt compelled to maintain a perfect facade despite her struggles with motherhood, admitting that Mason was a difficult baby and motherhood wasn't what she expected. The novel asks us to consider how easily we judge mothers while ignoring the complex realities they face. As Willingham notes in her author's statement, she wrote this story to explore what it would feel like to be trapped in the mind of a sleep-deprived mother who believes her child's disappearance was her fault. She observes that mothers and women are conditioned to feel guilty about everything, being too much or too little, wanting children or not wanting them at all. Through Isabel's journey, we witness the devastating consequences of secrets, shame, and silence, how they ripple through generations, causing irreparable harm. But we also see the possibility of healing when truth finally emerges into the light. By confronting her past and uncovering what really happened to both Margaret and Mason, Isabel breaks the cycle of trauma that has defined her family for decades. In doing so, she finds not just her son, but herself. The self she lost long ago in the murky waters of guilt and grief. Willingham masterfully weaves together past and present, showing how our childhood traumas shape our adult lives in ways we may not even recognize. The marsh that claimed Margaret becomes the same marsh where Mason's dinosaur is found, a symbolic connection between two losses separated by decades. Isabel's sleepwalking, a response to childhood trauma, returns when she becomes a mother herself, bringing her buried fears to the surface. The novel's title, All the Dangerous Things, refers not just to external threats, but to the dangerous secrets we keep, the dangerous assumptions we make, and the dangerous ways we protect ourselves from painful truths. For Isabel's father, the dangerous thing was prioritizing the family's reputation over getting her mother proper help. For Ben, it was manipulating women who resembled each other, using them as interchangeable pieces in his carefully constructed life. For Isabel herself, the most dangerous thing was believing she was responsible for tragedies beyond her control. In the end, Isabel discovers that the greatest danger lies not in what we do while sleepwalking, but in what we refuse to see when we're awake. By finally confronting the truth about her sister, her mother, her husband, and herself, she reclaims her agency and her future. The nightmares that have haunted her for years begin to fade, replaced by the simple, profound joy of holding her son again. As readers close this haunting thriller, we're left to consider our own dangerous things, the secrets we keep, the judgments we make, and the stories we tell ourselves to make sense of an often senseless world. Like Isabel, we might find that our greatest peace comes not from perfect sleep, but from finally waking up to the truth.